Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network, broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hey, and welcome to the Food Scene on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkell. In today's episode, Cameron Stock takes us on a journey into the world of vegetarian Vietnam, a culture and cuisine known for its brothy, complex pho soups and layered banh mi sandwiches, comes a vision of vegetarianism brought to light by Mahayana Buddhists. And now, Cameron, you first visited Hanoi in 2000 as a chef, as a tourist. Why was there an allure to that part of the world?
Well, I was living in Hong Kong at the time, and my wife and my in-laws went for a Christmas vacation, and they ended up going shopping for some lacquerware and silk, and I was like, no, I understand the street food here is really great. So I just wanted to be able to taste the freshness. I love the use of herbs in cuisines, and I understood that that existed in Vietnamese food. So I just wanted to kind of go out and first try that for the first time when we were there.
And so herbs, that is a British affectation, but you are a Canadian.
I am a Canadian.
So, but you have traveled the world, and this is what I find so fascinating. Through your wife's job, you have been able to live, not just travel to, but live in a lot of international cities for a good period of time.
Yeah, that's right. My wife's a Canadian diplomat, and so we've kind of always chosen places that have good food. So I've lived in Hong Kong, India, I lived in Delhi, I lived in Hanoi, Vietnam, and now I live in Bangkok. And we're generally there for a period of 3 or 4 years. So it's a way that while she's working, I'm trying to kind of find out as much as I can about the local food scene.
Yeah, but when you say something like, oh, I hear there's good street food here, how do you assimilate, how do you adopt a new culture, custom, cuisine?
Well, for me, the first thing that I like to do is I try to learn the language. I find that that helps as a great entry point. By learning the language, I can learn more about the culture. That way, I'm able to actually meet locals through teaching classes. When I go to the wet markets, I kind of start to try to dive in that way to learn as much as I can about the place that I'm at.
So pho is pronounced
pho.
And then banh mi is
banh mi.
Okay, so I've got two.
You've got two.
I can eat those two things, but I can eat those two things as meat items and vegetarian items. Because what was so fascinating about your book is that the majority of vegetarian dishes in Vietnam are just replicas or inspired by the meat ones.
Yeah, that's something that I have to say when I started my research when I was there. That kind of threw me because you'd be in a vegetarian restaurant and then it would say something like beef pho or something with shrimp. But there's always the word chai at the end, C-H-A-Y, which indicates that it's vegetarian. So sometimes the menus threw you off because they're indicating to the customer that this is a replica of this meat or seafood dish. So that was something that I had to wrap my head around and get used to.
But I mean, it must have been amazing to have that first bite of that nutty mushroom pate in a banh mi and then realize that you might not have been missing the meat.
Yeah, and I think actually what threw me the most was when I'd have that first banh mi that was really special, a vegetarian one, and go, wow, how did they do that with such simple ingredients and also minimal ingredients. So it was just trying to figure out what are they mimicking and how is, generally I say she because most of the cooks that I cooked with were women. So how did she prepare that? And then what I would do is I would take a look at I'd eat meat dishes and I'd eat seafood dishes and I'd try to see, okay, what are they trying to mimic and How are they trying to do the layers and so on and so forth?
Well, I think this word layers comes up quite often in your research, in your book, because of how layered and storied the influences of Vietnamese food is. You know, from the Khmer Empire to India and the trading routes of the Kham people and, you know, French, there are baguettes there. Mm. So how do you interpret through all of that?
Well, one, I think for me, it was just trying to find out as much information as I could, say through most of the stuff that I read, at least was in English. I can read basic Vietnamese, but more just cookbooks. But then it was by living in the part of the world that I've lived in, I was able to connect dots or just see influences like, oh, this dish is like this that I had in India, or here's, you know, Vietnam has such a strong Chinese influence from history with its food. So you could kind of see how things connected that way. So yeah, that's how.
Well, I mean, that helps that you've been positioned in that part of the world in different cities for so long too. But really the most intriguing part was a specific sect, the Mahayana Buddhists. And explain to me who they are in the greater context of Vietnam and what makes them as a people, even before their food, so special.
So the type of Buddhism that's practiced in Vietnam is Mahayana Buddhism, which first Buddhism came from India, and then it made its way into China, and it came down into Vietnam. And that type of Buddhism, where there's Theravada Buddhism, which is mainly more in Thailand, Sri Lanka, and so forth, and there they view vegetarianism in a different way. So the Mahayana Buddhists look that you should not kill anything for your own consumption, whereas Theravada Buddhists see that they will eat meat or seafood as long as it was not killed for their own consumption. So lay people will maybe make something, you know, in Thailand, make something that's meat or seafood, they'll make it for their family, and then they'll donate it to the local monastery.
Yeah. So you don't mean like getting hit by a car? Or...
No. Okay. Nothing like that.
But I thought it was such an interesting distinction, because the replication of these meat dishes came from, this type of Buddhist not wanting to insult anybody while they cooked for them.
Right. My understanding is that originated in China, and what they wanted to do there, the monks wanted to invite people who ate meat and seafood into their home or into their monastery or temple. And so they cunningly made replicas in look and in texture, if they could, of the meat seafood dishes using seitan, using tofu, and that, you know, made its way into Vietnam. And then they've continued to do that, as well as some home cooks.
So does this term mindfulness comes up quite often. Does this connect to mindfulness in the sense of sustainability, or is mindfulness something else completely?
I think it is moving into the sustainability, but it's more the concept of mindful eating or mindful living. So I spent a couple... at all the monasteries or nunneries that I went to cook at, they live their life in a mindful way. So whether it was how they were cleaning, they were doing it with a purpose, but also being conscious of everything. And the same thing with their cooking when they're in the kitchens. There's no music blaring like there would be in a restaurant kitchen. Similarly, no hymns or anything like that being chanted, but they would do things purposefully and in a thoughtful manner. And that goes with eating as well, you know. So it's taking a bite of something, thinking as you're chewing slowly, thinking about where the food came from, the people who grew the food, giving thanks to the earth, you know, to those people. So it goes into that mindful eating aspect.
I mean, it's a type of meditation, maybe not transcendental, but what were you thinking about and what were you chewing on the first time you thought about what you were eating?
Mm. Well, I was in a nunnery outside of Hue, was kind of my first attempt at mindful eating. And there was young nuns, I would say, in their late teens, early 20s, and we were having a lunch. And it was a simple lunch of daikon glazed in soy sauce, some rice, some stir-fried greens, and a simple broth soup. And I took a number of daikon strips into my rice bowl, and I greedily shoved three into my mouth. And, you know, when you're doing mindful eating, in these instances, there's no talking. You're just kind of chewing slowly, quietly, trying to think about, you know, the nourishment that's feeding your body, where it came from. But as I bit into these daikon strips, I just realized I was crunching really loud, like you go into a crisp pickle. And I thought, God, I hope nobody hears me. And I looked up at the table, and you know, these 10 young nuns just were giggling at each other because my attempt, they knew I was attempting, but it wasn't as successful as it could have been. I think I should have just taken one.
Yeah.
And I could have quietly done that.
See, I like the slurping culture of ramen in Tokyo, and I've kind of grown to embrace it in a way that I try to out slurp, you know, in both amount that I eat as well as, you know, audible quality than anybody else around me. But this is the opposite end of the spectrum.
Yeah, and the thing that I also like, though, is like the nonverbal. I discovered you used your eyes a lot. If there was something on the table that somebody wanted passed, you could kind of see that they just kind of, you know, give a nudge with their eyes to say, hey, can you pass that over there, whether it's be soy sauce or maybe some like sesame salt or something. That's how they would communicate.
So have you taught your children this and have they learned it and stopped saying please and thank you because they can just look?
No, that hasn't happened. But actually, funny enough, just the last week, my son and his friend were practicing mindful eating with a raisin. You know, that's often the one that they start with because you can savor the sweetness and so on and so forth. And they just kind of greedily took it in. So we're like, guys, I think you failed. We got to do this again.
Luckily, I'm assuming there are plenty of raisins to be mindful for.
I think so.
Excellent. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk more to Cameron Stock about vegetarian Vietnam.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American, and that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's unique store in Lower Manhattan is home to perhaps the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan, plus the rarest natural sharpening stones and exquisitely designed tableware. They also host special events such as knife sharpening demonstrations and parties with New York's most famous chefs and restaurateurs. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the implicit and elegance of Japanese culture to your table, be it in your home or in the finest restaurant. For more information, visit korin.com.
Hey, and welcome back to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here today with Cameron Stock of Vegetarian Vietnam. And, you know, Vietnamese food has flourished in the U.S., mainly on the concept of red boat fish sauce. People love that ingredient, and it is in so many people's pantries that don't even know how to use it properly. But when we're talking vegetarian Vietnamese food, what do we do in substitute of that?
Yeah, that's one of the questions I get asked the most. And, you know, in Vietnam, I did come across some vegetarian fish sauce products. I really only came across one that I liked in taste, and it's hard to get here. So generally, it's just I use soy and some salt, some soy sauce and salt as a substitute. But then it's also looking at how can we bring, you know, umami that comes from fish sauce or other meat seafood-based dishes into the vegetarian repertoire. So it's looking at, you know, say soybean pastes, fermented tofu, seaweed, dried shiitake mushrooms, things like that can help boost that umami flavor into vegetarian dishes.
Well, it's that pantry, though simple, it's complex in the nuances and how you use it and the quality of what you use. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we can start by talking about just stocks, simply, and how important those are. Sesame seeds, mushroom powder, crispy fried shallots, toasted rice powder. How hard is it to stock yourself to start cooking Vietnamese food, specifically vegetarian?
Well, I think vegetarian or not vegetarian, I don't think it's hard at all. You know, if you're... in the time that you can make, I offer two different vegetable stocks that I've tried to make that you can cross over to under the cuisines. But in the time that you make those stocks, it's about an hour, hour and a half, you can get those other pantry basics up to running, like, you know, toasting your sesame seeds or crisping shallots. You know, there are some cheats that you can buy at the store if you kind of want to be a bit more lazy, or, you know, you just, you're one time you're running late and you want to get that. So it's easy to put them all together. And once you've got it, it's, I find Vietnamese food, once that pantry's set up, it's really quick to assemble, actually.
Yeah, so it's looking at almost like Ford. There's an assembly line once you actually have everything in its place.
Yeah, yeah.
So going to restaurants there, floating markets, etc. Talk to me about how you've seen dishes assembled and what ingredients you had never seen before and now incorporate into your cooking.
Mm. You know, I think the two ingredients that I really come to love that I hadn't encountered as much was yuba, or tofu skin, and then fresh young jackfruit, young green jackfruit. So not the ripe, but the unripe. And the great thing about the young ripe jackfruit is just that it takes on such great flavor, but it also adds texture. So, you know, a lot of cooks will use it to imitate, say, chicken, maybe pork or something like that in a salad or in a braise of some sort. And then the yuba, I just love how it's just got this great nutty flavor, and it's also creamy at the same time. And you can make it into just a fabulous vegetarian sausage. I think my recipe has like three or four ingredients. I had a lady in Vietnam teach it to me, and it's really quick to assemble. It's just that it takes time to steam. And there's a great product here in the United States that Hoda Soy does out of California, and it is amazing. That fresh tofu skin, I highly recommend that.
Oh, I love it as well.
Yeah, it's amazing.
One thing that you can't kind of skimp on, or you have to have the freshest and best, is herbs, or however you say that word. But these herbs are something that I know a lot of people trying to cook Vietnamese or even Thai food here had a hard time finding, and started sourcing seeds and getting farmers to grow. But go along the list of what important herbs there are in Vietnamese cuisine and whether or not they're available here, and if not, how to grow them.
Sure. Well, I think the first three simple ones that I think that you can find in any grocery store is you're looking at cilantro, mint, and then Thai basil. Can't necessarily always get Thai basil in the grocery store, but you could substitute Italian basil if you really were at a loss of where to find other things. And then you move on to Thai basil, dill, you have Vietnamese coriander, and then you have shiso or red perilla. And then there's some more obscure herbs, kind of like rice paddy herb, you know, which will be in different dishes. And the interesting thing with the vegetarian dishes is sometimes you can tell by the herb garnish when you're at a vegetarian restaurant what the dish is also. It's another indication of what is it mimicking. So that was another indicator that I was like, okay, this is, this herb is in it. So then this is, it's close to this.
Give me an example of that.
So like, for example, rice paddy herb, is in, kang chua. So it's a kind of a sweet and sour soup. That's generally used as a garnish there. Or you'll look at, shiso, the red shiso, there's a mock crab soup from the north. And that's generally used as a garnish there. And, you know, if you're really stuck, just use the cilantro, the mint, or the basil as your kind of basic herbs if you're stuck on where to find it. The best places to go are really Vietnamese or Southeast Asian grocers. But sometimes you can find, like, culantro. You'll be able to go to a Latin American grocer for that as well. So there is some crossover. You just have to kind of find out in your area.
See, when I start cooking Vietnamese food, and I don't attempt it often, and you're going to help me through this, and so is this book, I know how to make a soy chili dipping sauce. I can do, you know, the pickled daikon and radish. I kind of pump the brakes at tofu. Because as much as I know there is good tofu in this country, I do not know how to work with it as well as I want. Mm. And even more intimidating is making it at home. But you write it out so simply, you know, tricks such as pressing for frying, both deep, shallow, and pan, baking, freezing for textural modification. how big of a staple is tofu within vegetarian Vietnamese food?
It's quite a big staple. The thing that I discovered in the north was that in the north they tended to want to have a lot more seitan in their as their mock meat in dishes. In the center and the south, there seemed to be a lot more tofu. I think a lot more people here in North America prefer tofu over seitan, so I kind of focused more on that.
How do you feel about it, though?
I feel the same, actually.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, no, I feel the same, but I think it's still important. Like, I added a seitan recipe. And then we've also got some, you know, of these faux meats that are coming up, you know, Beyond Meat and so on and so forth, where they've got a Beyond Chicken that I think's got a great texture and actually a good taste. And I've included just a couple recipes with ingredients like that, because I think that if a Vietnamese vegetarian cook had access to them, I think that they'd be using them. So that's why I just did that for a couple things, but people can easily adjust them in the book if they need to.
Or you can just have a vegetarian banh mi, as is in the book, and enjoy it like that. You know, going into more street snacks, there's a lot of rice-based things, from rice paper, spring rolls, but then you have, you know, noodle roll-ups. Talk to me about what street food is relative to the food you did or food you cooked in people's homes.
The food, for me, the food in people's homes I found to be much more simply prepared. Just a few ingredients put together. Sometimes there'd be something a bit longer, like there might be take time to make roll something that has to be steamed. Whereas the street food stuff, there was a greater mise en place, but it was quickly assembled and then being able to eat, right there on the street. You'd have some of the noodle soups, though, that would require some cooking in advance by the cook, you know, at the shop or at the street stall. And then it was, again, a quick assembly. So once that stock was done, you know, it's in your bowl at your table or at your feet within a minute. So it's that idea of that the mise en place, once it's all set up, you can quickly put it together.
So you're saying they're masterful at like casual, fast casual, quick service restaurants.
I think fast casual with amazing layers of flavor, texture, freshness. And the thing that always blows me away is how light you feel after eating Vietnamese food. There would be meals where I'd have, you know, two or three things, and then I'd be like, 20 minutes later, I'm like, I'm kind of hungry, but I was also, satiated as well. So, I think that Vietnamese cooks, I think they're one of the best there are out there.
One of my favorite dishes is vermicelli noodles with fresh turmeric. Mm. Usually what is ka cha, it's usually done with like a catfish but you have a version in here with tofu and Chinese chives. That dish, it's one of those that I can eat 20 bowls of, well, feel satiated after one, but just want to keep eating and eating and never feel kind of weighed down by it.
Well, and I think that's a good example, too, of dishes that are deceptively simple, but have maximum flavor. You know, the turmeric is kind of the main flavor, but then you've got those Chinese chives that acts of accents, some tofu or mushrooms for texture. And again, it's a simple, quickly put together, but the flavor is there. That kind of always surprising to me how tasty it is, and it's so quick.
Something that I love here, you know, we eat a lot of oatmeal in the U.S., but porridge. And I kind of want to talk about rice in the context that it is so versatile in Vietnam, you know, from sticky to, you know, crispy to using it as a batter for crepes. Talk to me about that versatility, the simplicity of, you know, making those things, but the complexity of eating them.
Well, I think that you'll find in Vietnam that rice in some form is always at the meal, you know, so you're either getting noodles in a dry dish or in a bowl, a noodle soup, or you're going to have chow. So like the rice porridge might be a nice comforting dish. And then you're going to find it, whether in it be like the wrappers or in the crackers, or like you said, in bang sao with the lentil and the rice flour batter. So rice is just kind of part of life there. I guess that's all I can say.
It's great. It's contextually, it's a carrier for a lot of other things too, because what you have at the markets are usually a plethora of greens, simply stir-fried or sautéed. You have a bright green herby omelet, which I'm definitely going to try. That's in the book. But again, nothing seems that complex or out of reach. So it's a matter of setting yourself up for it, reading that recipe through, and giving it an attempt, because they are so wonderfully layered recipes, and you feel like you've accomplished something so much more complex than you have.
And I think something that's important that I found in Vietnamese cuisine is kind of not omitting ingredients, because sometimes if you miss that one little ingredient, you don't realize how important it is.
Yeah.
So even something that I was surprised at was freshly ground black pepper in vegetarian cooking. That final little twist on a noodle soup, like on pho, just kind of brightened everything. And I would notice it if it wasn't added. And you were just like, huh, what's missing? And then I'd be like, oh, it's that.
Yeah.
It's the same thing with salads. If you're missing the crispy shallots or the peanuts or the toasted sesame seeds. And that's why I say with the herbs, go with those three or at least two of those three, because you'll at least still have that layer of flavor.
You actually have that caveat in your book, and it is the most nicely discouraging way of saying no substitutions, please. But it's true. These dishes are built on layers and layers of foundation, not just one block. Mm-hmm. So you need that whole gamut of things for it to be complete. And we're going to finish with a Vietnamese coffee, because that is, aside from pho or banh mi, is probably the most ubiquitously known Vietnamese dish, but it's not really Vietnamese.
Well, I think you've got the influence with the French, right? Bringing in the canned milk into Vietnam. But I think that's the thing with Vietnamese food and culture, is they have, as a people, have always been able to take influences from other cultures and make it their own and make it uniquely Vietnamese, which I think is what's wonderful about just Vietnamese cuisine when you look at the different influences coming from other cultures. So they can do it with coffee, they can do it with bread and banh mi, they can do it with the noodles and stocks and things like that from the Chinese, or some influences from the French. But I think that's the unique kind of, you know, USP to Vietnamese food and culture, that I always loved seeing how they could do that.
And what's wonderful, you talk about this uniqueness, but the perspective you give too, not just as a vegetarian, or not that you are a vegetarian, but in the lens of vegetarianism, as a Canadian, as a world traveler, as a chef, is so wonderfully done in this book. It's so wonderfully dense with information and understanding and mindfulness that, you know, you should be very proud of that.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It was fun writing it.
Excellent. Well, everyone should go out and get this book today, and we can find more about you and your adventures at aglobaltable.com. Thank you very much for being on.
Thank you very much, Michael.
A big thank you to Corin for sponsoring, music by Cookies, and David Tadashore Engineering. And hope to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Ever wonder what kind of podcast Julia Child would have made? Probably would have been one where she introduced you to all of her latest discoveries and favorite people. And that's exactly the tradition we're following on Inside Julia's Kitchen, the podcast of the Julia Child Foundation for Gastronomy and the Culinary Arts. Join me, Todd Shulkin, your host, and the Foundation's Executive Director, as I bring you inside the Foundation's world to meet the bright lights of today's food universe, just as Julia used to do from her own famous kitchen. New episodes air on Heritage Radio Network, Wednesdays at noon Eastern. Listen in.